Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Selectionary, the podcast that codifies the canon of films from one of the world's greatest animation directors, Henry Selick. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm sewing them together for the first time.
So join us in our quest into the glorious world of Henry Selick. Jake, Steph, welcome back. You know, I introduced this as The Selectionary. This is the stealth mid-season reboot as well.
Yeah, this is like the Fast Five, where we introduced Dwayne Johnson, and we're kind of pivoting towards more action spectacle rather than focus on cars, right?
Yes, yeah. I suppose.
It's Travis Knight, the Dwayne Johnson of the podcast.
The takes are flying already. We're 30 seconds in.
And does that make the rest of the Leica filmography Hobbs and Shaw?
Yeah. When we get to the Furious Seven of Leica, that's when it really kicks off.
And now I'm just asking, who's Han in this in this analogy?
Oh yeah, because the timeline's all messed up, really. Maybe actually this is the Tokyo Drift, where actually the timelines merge on Tokyo Drift and then split out again.
This is a way of saying, labouring the point, that this is the final episode of The Selectionary for now, because this is Henry Selick's current final feature. Of course, he has Wendell and Wilde coming out very soon, and it is our first episode of the Leicanography, because he worked with Leica Studios coming out of Portland, Oregon on their first feature, and they've gone on to make many features since, which we will now explore. So the track does break from here, the trail does fork in the road from here on out.
But I think it's not like we are drawing a line in the sand. I think all of those future Leica films and episodes are going to be tying all the way back to Nightmare Before Christmas and everything that we've already spoken about there. It's very exciting. A new venture, our first, a Leica sequel. You know, we're rebooting, but carrying on the same story at the same time. Get the new fans in, serve the legacy fans.
Yeah, as one door closes, another tiny creepy one that you have to find a big old key for opens, and we crawl into a fantasy world.
Is the Leicanography our other podcast?
We're getting ahead of ourselves. Of course, this week we are talking about Coraline from 2009. If you haven't watched that film in the decade or so since it came out, go away and watch it now. We'll be there. We'll still be here when you come back, because we'll be going deep on this one. There's so much to talk about. Steph, before we start, can you tee us up with a synopsis recap?
Of course. Wandering her rambling old house in her boring new town, Coraline discovers a hidden door to a fantasy version of her life. In order to stay in the fantasy, she must make a frighteningly real sacrifice. Michael, Coraline's making some big sacrifices in the story, but you've made the sacrifice for us of going away and researching all of the context for this film. It's a big one.
Yeah, I think looking at the document that's been constructed for this, I fear this might be the biggest context section you've ever made, even maybe bigger than some of the Ghiblis.
Hey, don't set me up like that. Set me up for a fall. That's because many reasons, of course. This is a film very close to my heart. This was one of the first films I covered as a young sort of movie blogger slash journalist way back when. Of course, I loved the film as well, loved the book it was based on. But this is so important to this pivot we're making from the Selectionary to the Lycanography, because we're almost reintroducing a whole new cast of characters. So I think it warrants a little bit of a longer context. But where should we start? Last time, on the Monkey Bone episode, we left Henry Selick in director's prison because that film made $7 million on a $70 million budget. But there was one project bubbling away in the background. So Neil Gaiman, who we've talked about on this pod before, he wrote the English dub screenplay for Princess Mononoke. He was a beloved comics writer, novelist, author. He was finishing off the manuscript for a kid's novella called Coraline, which he'd been working on for about 10 years on and off. He started it for one of his kids, finished it 10 years later for another one of his kids. He shared that unpublished manuscript with Henry Selick because he thought that it would make a great stop-motion film. And Selick agreed. And he went to Bill Mechanic, who we mentioned on the Monkey Bone episode. He was that exec that greenlit Monkey Bone before he was kicked out of Fox, reportedly by Rupert Murdoch. But Bill Mechanic had started an independent production company called Pandemonium Films and accepted this project, helped out Selick. So Selick had, on the one hand, a very collaborative author of a source novel and his exec behind him. But this was still the early 2000s, and of course Coraline didn't see the light of day until 2009, so things did move very slowly, and Selick would talk about this period of his career being possibly the worst, the hardest times. He worked on the script of Coraline for about a year or so, and then would break and go and work on other things, commercial projects. One big gig he had in the early 2000s was working with Wes Anderson on the animated sequences in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Wes Anderson and Henry Selick really hit it off, and Selick said he learned a lot from working so closely with Wes Anderson. And in fact, he was attached at one point to direct Fantastic Mr. Fox, the Roald Dahl adaptation, that Wes Anderson instead directed himself, and that became his first animated feature. And all the while, Coraline was bubbling in the background. There was a weird agreement. This is really interesting to read about in interviews. When Bill Mechanic set up his new company, he agreed or promised that they wouldn't develop animated projects, some sort of deal he had with Disney. So they pretended for a couple of years that they were developing a live-action version of Coraline, which is a really weird flex, right? I think Henry Selick talks about meeting with Michelle Pfeiffer to play the other mother at one point in a live-action version, and they get Dakota Fanning involved when she thought she'd be playing the character in live-action. But all that changes when Selick forms a relationship with a fledgling studio based in Oregon called Leica. He initially moves up there from his base in California to help flesh out a short film project that they were working on in-house called Moon Girl. And that's finished in 2005, and he sticks around pitching Coraline to them as a project for them to take on. Now, this is where things get long, because we have to introduce Leica, don't we? Let's start with the company before Leica. That was called Will Vinson Studios, based in Portland, Oregon. Will Vinson was an influential, long-standing figure in animation, and an Oscar winner as well. He specialised in claymation, so probably more on the Aardman side than the Henry Selick side. And possibly his most enduring work, at least in the mainstream, was a bunch of characters called California Raisins, which had their roots in an advertising campaign for raisins in the 80s, but then became like TV stars in their own right and released like songs. Like, I heard it through the grapevine. They had a hit with that. That was like a whole little media empire that came out of Will Vinson Studios. But once the 90s rolled around, they really started to struggle. But they did have young local animators coming through the ranks, and one of them was a lad called Travis Knight. and he's like now the main character, the Dwayne Johnson, if you will, of the rest of the iconography. He was a keen animator, hard worker, and apparently something of a prodigy, but he also had something that none of his colleagues had, an incredibly rich dad. So that's Phil Knight, co-founder of Nike, and according to Forbes in 2020, the 24th richest person in the world. Phil, probably spotting that Travis has found his calling, buys into Will Vinson Studio and increases that investment over the years until he has a controlling stake. And he even edges Will Vinson out because he was facing bankruptcy. So he kicked Will Vinson out of his own studio in the end. And there's a wild story from a feature I read, which I'll link to in the footnotes. Phil landed on the name Leica before he even knew that it was in reference to the space dog. So we have, you know, we love studio names on the podcast, and all these, you know, Ghibli and Ponoc and Cartoon Saloon, all these places that really pick or labor over what their studio name is. And Leica, apparently, Phil likes words with K's in the middle, like Nike and Leica. But then if you think about the imagery behind that, it's space dog, it's pioneering, it's the first mammal in space, but it's also the first mammal to die in space and be burnt up on re-entry. So is that a good name for a vanity project like sinking millions and millions of dollars into stop motion animation? I don't know, we'll see. But then Travis, who's only a handful of years into his career at that point, is suddenly given a place at the board of the studio, and he's like 30 or something. Let's put a pin in that story because there's another wild little stop off I'd like to make. This isn't Travis Knight's first career. Before he turned to animation, he rapped, and he actually released an album in the early 90s under the rap persona Chili T, which is wild. I mean the actual album was produced by the Bomb Squad, who were like Public Enemy's production team. So, you know, it's kind of as legit as a suburban white kid, son of a billionaire, could be. I realise this context is getting on long, so, but maybe off mic, Jake, Steph, I'd recommend going and looking up the music video.
How would you describe the music of Chili T, Michael?
I mean, at least it looks like he's coming out in the slipstream of Vanilla Ice. But it sounds not bad, because the Bomb Squad are a really good production team. So it doesn't sound bad at all. It's it just looks awkward because it's Travis Knight, who we now know as being a great animator and studio head. But he's, you know, wearing a backwards cap and, you know, crouching in front of a camera, spitting bars. Anyway, we'll link to the YouTube music video in the comments. But anyway, he turned his back on what I'm sure was a very you know, budding career in hip hop to turn to animation, and animation was his calling. And Henry Selick himself said that Travis was one of the best stop motion animators in the world at that point, and he owed Coraline getting the green light to him. It was the project that Travis wanted to work on, and Selick went out and sought out a distributor, Focus Features over at Universal, and everything just progressed from there. So let's bear in mind, this is the mid-2000s. This is a good decade after James and the Giant Peach, and so much had changed production-wise, and Selick, almost for the first time in a long while, had the support and the budget to realise this film on a scale previously unseen. So he got given $70 million for this film. And that's not $70 million because, you know, Brendan Fraser was expensive off the back of The Mummy. This is $70 million because they wanted to invest in the craft. And they had a cavernous warehouse for a studio with 150 sets, some of them massive and detailed, like the mansion at the heart of the film that they move into. They had 24 individual puppets for Coraline. The crew was like 450 people strong at its peak of production. They had motion control cameras allowing these beautiful movements and tracking shots through the miniature sets. This film was pioneering in the sense that they used 3D printing to help create a lot of the sets and props and characters. It meant they could create hundreds of thousands of facial expressions for particularly like Coraline or the other characters, because they were printing off so many different facial features to use in the puppets. It was shot in stereoscopic 3D. Remember, that was a thing in the 2000s. So this was an immensely ambitious project. And the great thing about it, after 18 months of production, released February 2009 in the States, May in the UK, it was successful. It won critical acclaim and eventually took home like $120 million at the box office, another 40-odd million on top of that in the home video. It won Best Animated Feature at the BAFTAs. It won Best Feature at Annecy, shared with Barry and Max, the Australian film. And it was nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Oscars. Now, this is an incredibly stacked year at the Oscars. In fact, we've talked about this very Best Animated Feature category two times before, because it was the year that Cartoon Saloon had their nomination, their surprise nomination, some would say, for The Secret of Kells. It's also the year that Ponyo wasn't nominated. It couldn't make it into this crowded field. So we know Secret of Kells and Coraline made the cut in this year at the Oscars. Can you think of any other of the nominations or who won that year?
Is it Up?
Up won that year. Huh. So you have two other films. I've already mentioned one of the films in this context.
Have you now? Well, mm-hmm. Testing how much we've been paying attention, are you? Clever. Classic teacher move. What would have been out in 2009? How to Train Your Dragon.
Nope, that's the following year. So the film I mentioned earlier was one directed by a filmmaker that Selleck greatly admired and worked with.
Oh,
and
was Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah. And then the last one is Disney. At the time, this was seen as almost a return to form for Disney, certainly a return to a filmmaking style they had.
Princess and the Frog.
Yep. Steph, I'm disappointed you didn't get the frog one.
I was about to say it. Jake jumped in.
Sorry, Steph.
In your world, it's the frog and the princess. But that's it. So Coraline is a big hit and is still to this day beloved. In a similar way to The Night Before Christmas, a lot of young goths were created by this film or sustained through their teenage years by this film. And weirdly, Henry Selick doesn't go on to make many films after this, but Laika go from strength to strength and have several films after this that we'll be talking about in future episodes. But before that, we do have to talk about Coraline, don't we? And maybe I could have a breather while Jake and Steph, you tell me what you thought of the film.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, that was probably the longest context in Ghibli Attack history. But first, Jake, Steph, I want to know how this is running on from previous Selicks. So who do I want to go to first? The person that liked Monkey Bone or didn't like Monkey Bone? Jake, is this back on track after Monkey Bone?
Oh, I don't know. Yes, yeah, this is considerably better than Monkey Bone. I'm willing to admit it. This is really good, and it's so obviously the same filmmaker and a filmmaker that feels confident and rejuvenated, and nicely not disowning Monkey Bone as well. I feel like he learned some stuff with that film that he's brought to this too. I think you really can see the evolution of him as a storyteller across these four films, even if we might want to ignore one of them. And in a way, like, there's stuff that I like in this film that maybe wouldn't be there without Monkey Bone. So maybe I've got to give Monkey Bone its due there. I'd say Coraline isn't as good without it. I think this is, well, spoiling my ballot later, but this is, for me, the best thing that I've seen him do. I think there's a real cohesion between form and story that we haven't seen. I think perhaps in his first two films, he really wants to show you what he can do with the form. He wants to showcase his skills as an animator, and maybe emotional investment in the story goes by the wayside, or kind of a satisfying story. And that's not to say the Coraline story is perfect, but I think it's his film in which you get most invested in the characters and what they're up to. And formally, it is just stunning. It's so, so beautiful. Like, particularly all of the stuff in the other world, the way it uses lights is just like nothing I've ever seen. And God, yeah. I like it a lot, and there's lots to get into. We could go for it. I know you could have gone forever on your context, and we could probably go for long on our review. But Steph, I'm going to hazard a guess and say you like this film.
Yes, decidedly more than Monkey Bone. Even though I do defend Monkey Bone, I think a great place to start is just those opening credits sequences. Like you said, Jake. You know, he's carrying some stuff over from Monkey Bone, that kind of opening title of close up creating something, and we get like the Coraline doll being all stitched together. It's kind of like a upside down underworld version of Woody being repaired lovingly in Toy Story. It's really kind of, detailed and close up and almost relaxing in a way, but you can't quite be relaxed because it's so creepy, and just, you know, from the get-go that this is going to be very kind of gothic, very disturbing, and like very Henry Selick. I think this is probably the film where you know you're watching him the most, like, over the ones that we've watched. I think straight from the get-go it's that. And I think what grabs me so much in this film as well is just how smooth the animation is. Like, genuinely, the first time I watched it, I was like, are you sure this is stop motion? Because it's so... I feel like there's points where you can tell, and then there's points where it just looks like water flowing or whatever. Like, it just looks amazing. And even, like, looking at behind-the-scenes videos of how they did certain shots, and it's not even like they're using computer graphics for it. It's like, I think there's a bit where she gets sprayed on the head by a dirty shower, and that's just mad little fiberglass molds that they've made, and it just looks like real water. It's just the like level of artistry in it. You can see where that 70 mil has gone on like making everybody move so smoothly.
Well, and I think that opening is him like calling its shot as well. Like, I think that's the sign of a very confident person, because he's replicating a thing that went down really badly, opening it again, redoing it, and it's so focused on craft. It's like putting the craft of the film under a magnifying glass at the very start and saying, pay attention to how this is being made. Like, really look at it, because it is so well made. and you can't not, like, this, as I said, the story is good, but like, it's just astonishing to look at. And Steph, that movement, I think we're seeing that evolution of his skill as an animator who knows how to work the camera. And he's benefiting from that technology that you mentioned, Michael, those motion sensitive cameras that can track the stop motion and give it so much more fluidity and momentum than we've ever seen. And he does that. We do get bits of that in a kind of twirling way in Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach, but it's not kind of there all the time. It's like these flourishes of movement. And compared to Fantastic Mr. Fox, which comes out the same year, like that's a very stately approach to framing. Like that's a film in which the camera would never move because Wes Anderson wants to show you the world that he's built and you view it in these perfect vistas. Whereas it's quite amazing to see such abandon with the movement of the camera considering the world that's been built. Like he really throws it around and it feels like a horror film because you get these crash zooms, you get these Dutch angles, and you get these dolly shots in there. And these are real live action techniques and quite enlarged techniques that I think feel at home from Monkey Bone as well. And yeah, it's both the combination of the things that have been built in front of the camera and the way the camera captures them is so perfectly matched here.
The technique that comes to mind as you're listing those off, Jake, there's so much first person mm-hmm. in this as well, where you're looking through Coraline's eyes. And that's something that is testament to their technology, where they create this huge mansion set and the gardens outside. I'd recommend anyone go and look up some behind the scenes pictures of this, because they are just massive sets. And then the cameras really can go up close to these puppets and really scrutinize all those details. It's really beautiful. And I think all the way back on, I think, the James the Giant Peach episode, I had that quote from him, which was how he characterized both Nightmare Before Christmas and James the Giant Peach, where he said he likes stories which go through portals into other worlds. But he also believes that a story should be as simple and as straightforward as possible, so that the animation can then fly off in different directions and then be experimental and be expressionistic. And I think both those, if those are the two motifs and modus operandi of Henry Selick as a filmmaker, they're achieved really well here, because structurally, story-wise, all we have are two worlds connected by a tunnel, and our character is just bouncing back and forth between them, visiting the same characters in each, and how they're different on both sides of that tunnel. And then a final sequence, an absolutely bravura sequence towards the end, which we can talk about later. But it's full of ideas. And we've said before about this almost variety show idea that he brings, which is ideas-led, creativity-led, design-led, where you'll have a dance sequence or a musical sequence in these films just because he's kind of showing off, because he wants to show that this is what animation can do. And that returns here. Is that something that was he successful there on that front? Is he showing us something new, or is it all old hat to us by now?
I think it felt similar to the way that he's presented stories before, and that it's like this showcase where you get the gymnast man that is upstairs and he does his routine, and then you get the circus bit and you're bouncing around, and like all of that is the stuff that I really love about it. I think it's in the last half an hour that the film falters from a story perspective, because I'm very happy to just spend time in this world, to wander between the two of them, and I don't really need much in the way of heightened stakes. And I think it's just a bit uninspired, maybe, in the final act, when it suddenly becomes a bit of a MacGuffin hunt and you have to find these three balls from these three ghosts, and I don't
care.
The
eyes of the dead children.
Yeah, like they're creepy.
That are planted around.
Yeah, like they're creepy, and they allow for us to explore some beautiful locations, and you get that great bit with the mower that's also a mantis, and that's really cool. But also, I don't care. It's just a bit kind of tedious that it had to go down a quite obvious route to spur up an action-led final act.
I think that's part and parcel with the fact that this is a kids' novella, yeah. And probably one of the parts of the film which hews more closely to the book, because it does have to show the monster and then subvert the monster.
Yeah. I think like, because your emotional attachment to Coraline is the thing that carries you through, and so then when you need to shift that emotion towards these other characters, you don't feel it in the same way. Like, you are invested with her because she is so well crafted. You've got all that details of the face. You've got her interactions with her parents. Like, I think it's really well observed. For stop motion, which takes so much time, it feels so natural in the way that they move, but the way that they interact as well, like her just kind of aimlessly swinging a door and it's squeaking and annoying her dad, it's just so instantly irritating. Or the way that a screaming child's sound from another room demanding something, it really paints a vivid picture of their family life, and it is that family that is the core of it for me. To me, it's like, this is about adolescence and kind of breaking away from doctrination and kind of orthodoxy that's presented in front of you. And you can step away from that. And it's good to be independent, but also you can kind of embrace the mundanity of your parents as well. Like, you don't need to be entirely separate from them, and you don't need to just fall in line. And I like that. And I don't need dead ghost kids to make me feel more invested in that.
An aspect of this that really struck me on this watch, in a similar way to how The Nightmare Before Christmas struck me as a midlife crisis film rather than a finding my people kind of identity film, is that this film and the story as well has almost like a two-pronged thematic approach. So it has, why is this scary for kids? Because there is the grass is always greener kind of aspect of, well, what if my parents were cool and loving and perfect and all that stuff, and the uncanniness around that. But seeing this as a film written by a parent and then put to the screen by adults as well, there's something in here that is almost like a parental anxiety thing, because when I'm, we are all right now mostly working from home in the middle of a heat wave, where we are just like the dad in this, just slumped over our laptops.
we're living the meme. It was quite fun to see that meme in the wild of the film.
Exactly.
Yeah, that has been all us.
We are all him. And this coming out of a period of Neil Gaiman's life where he was a struggling writer, having his first success, but still very much having to pump out a lot of words per day. And having a kid, probably having that anxiety of, I wish I was this parent that could be providing everything this person needs. But anyway, what you're saying there, Jake, is a really interesting encapsulation of something we've talked about on this podcast before. Would you prefer this film if this had an ending like Spirited Away, where it collapsed all the third act into into 2 minutes?
I think I might, and then you just have a 10-minute slideshow of all the locations. It's a funny one, and I get why it's there, and I can see the demands that would have been made to make it happen. Other than the thrill of kind of doing a world collapsing plus car chase that looks like a bug sequence, I can't imagine that Selleck is maybe as invested in the emotional beats of what's going on. But it, as we said, it looks amazing, and that you mentioned the uncanniness of it, like, kind of moving on to the way that these worlds have been built. I think it's fascinating, and I can't quite put my finger on exactly what makes it so strange, because the real world kind of looks unfinished. Like, it looks like someone's built a model world, like a doll's house, and forgotten about it. Like, it's got these big brush strokes over all the furniture that look like it's been made by a child for dolls to live in. So it kind of feels empty, and it's all kind of low saturation in the colors. But then you move to the other world, and it's bright and it's beautiful. But between them, it's like our world house is ugly and it's barren and it's cold, but it feels homely. And the other world is like this beautiful and bright thing, but feels unsettling. And he does such an amazing job in making you feel that, but not being able to nail down exactly why, and that only adds to the unsettling feeling of watching the whole film.
I think that's where the like emotional connect, like, I found quite a lot of emotional investment in the film. I think especially with like Coraline and her mum, because that's the main kind of like conflict in the film, is like she doesn't feel like her real mother like understands her. Like they're constantly kind of butting up against each other in that kind of, you know, early teen girl and mum way that can like happen quite a lot. And they just like butt heads all the time. She has a lot, you know, to say about, you know, you're a gardener, you have this mug that says I love mulch, but you never go out in the garden. Like you're just sitting at your laptop all day. And I think that's like maybe part of the why the real house feels so kind of empty, because it doesn't have like any passion from the parents in it. Like they're obviously providing for her, but she doesn't see like love. Like she feels lonely, she doesn't feel understood by them. And then like the other mother, you know, gives her everything she wants, but I don't, like, she doesn't actually understand her or want to. She just wants her to be, you know, her little minion, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think like a scene that really, really touched me was when they're at the uniform store and she really wants the pair of gloves, and you know, her mum's doing the whole like, no, stop complaining, blah blah blah, like leave me alone, you'll get what you're given. But then she like goes back and buys the gloves for her because she recognizes that she's like sacrificed a lot and like by moving out there and moving for her parents. And that's something like that the other mother would never do. So I think there is a lot of like emotional connection in there. It's just, yeah, you know, it's quite subtle within that like grand world and all of this crazy stuff and that kind of really mad third act of, you know, the spider mother and that void world and stuff.
I think that's something that's quite almost wise and subtle about the storytelling here, is that the parents are failing parents only for a short while. It's actually in the grand scheme of Coraline's life and the parents' lives, it's just, we have a project that we're both working on. We don't have the money to buy those gloves and we don't have the time to go and cook. Please hold on, Coraline. But in like a kid's, from her point of view, oh my god, life is so boring and dragging on for ages, why have you pulled me away from my friends? So that's why I like that ending. That ending isn't that the parents came to some great realization that, oh, we've been ignoring Coraline. It was just the simple fact of the catalogue got approved and we now have some money to splash out on nice food and gloves.
Well, I think that's, yeah, and you have the 20 minutes before that that you don't actually need, that you could snip out, and they come to that revelation. But in a way, it's quite a Hosoda final act, in the stakes entirely change and you enter a white void space in which things are on a kind of geometric grid are disappearing.
But for me, that is just showing off, right? Because that's him playing with tools that he didn't have in the early 90s, where he could. I mean, that is very VFX heavy, what they're doing there, being able to suspend these characters in voids and have the world peeling away around them. This was by far the best 3D film I saw at the cinema back when 3D was a thing for a few years. Particularly sequence, every time the tunnel unfurls, when the other dad has the player piano with the hands that pop out, and when that bit where the entire the floor falls away underneath Coraline in that final act, all that stuff is just, it's just showing off, really. But it works really well. And it gets to the heart of Henry Selick, where he's, this might be something we'll talk about with Leica as we go on. He is a, I've said it before, experimental filmmaker at his heart, working within mainstream filmmaking. And he wants to bring in these experiments and isn't just purely trying to make films with stop motion characters, although he is using lots of filmmaking techniques. He does want to have a lot of fun and bring in some visual ideas as well. The idea about this final act and the creepiness and the horror aspects, there's all sorts of stuff that Selick has touched on in interviews, and I don't think it's ever really fully been, you know, fully been expanded on. But Leica and Travis Knight always backed him. So for a change, he had the studio and the person who had the purse strings on his side. But Focus Features and Bill Mechanic were quite jumpy about this film, and they kept bringing in very conflicting notes, like Pixar's doing really well, make it lighter. And then Harry Potter comes out. Oh, you should make it darker, like those Harry Potter movies, make it scarier for kids. At one point, Henry Selick had written this as a full musical, and They Might Be Giants, the alt-pop band who did they do have one song, the Other Dad's song, which is also TikTok famous.
Malcolm in the Middle, right?
Yeah, they did the theme tune for Malcolm in the Middle, plus lots of hits before that. Birdhouse in Your Soul, lots of Tiny Toons Adventures music videos as well. But yeah, so the making up a song about Coraline song, which is They Might Be Giants, but they wrote 10 songs for this. They demoed a lot, and then it was scrapped at one point that it wouldn't be a musical and it would be a feature film in this way. So it did change a lot. As we've said before, there are all these sort of slightly jumpy execs in the background or creative forces, but I feel that this one landed in a way that is a real testament and almost the perfect version of Coraline.
Mm.
Although people do like to dream, there's a note on our document here that we've got to get to, and my way of teeing this up is I was very privileged. I was like 21 and I didn't know anything about films, and I had the opportunity to interview both Neil Gaiman and Henry Selick about this film separately, and it was amazing, of course. But one thing that always stuck in my head is that when I asked Selick about his influences and what inspired him, he said that Hayao Miyazaki inspired him.
Mm.
And I think at the time I was like, oh, what an interesting thing to say. He must just be dropping that name because it's the current big name. But now that we're going back through these films and we're seeing how he really does like to tip the hat to all these other filmmakers when he can show off different types of animation, there are a lot of weird Ghibli parallels in here. Which some of which are in the Gaiman book, so of course, whatever, all of Gaiman's got a connection with Miyazaki too. But we should go through these. I mean, I guess the big one is the very story is about a girl in that sort of tweeny or early teeny years being taken away from her friends and moving house.
Yep.
So
you got a bit of Totoro there, you got a bit of Marnie there, you got a bit of Spirited Away there.
Absolutely. That's something that they return to. We have a black cat that sometimes talks and sometimes doesn't and has a sort of magical aura to them, which is Kiki's Delivery Service. We have, the whole section early on in the film where they're opening up the doors and she's looking through the house and rattling windows and stamping out bugs in the bathroom. That's very Totoro as well. You also have one of the voice actors of the sisters in Totoro in the Disney dub. You have the elder one in this case, Dakota Fanning. A dorky friend. I think YB. I've never felt more seen than with YB. Because you don't often, particularly in sort of mainstream American animated films, just get someone who is such an unrepentant dork as he is. And particularly the way he's animated.
Oh, the way he holds himself is so funny.
He's always shrugging and like he's sort of curling up into a ball with anxiety, and the way his head is lolling to the side. There's one bit where he walks backwards into a sort of backflip tumble just because of a ball of anxiety, which is just wonderful. But he's kind of like Tombo, isn't he? Like a sort of boy that the main character, the very willful female character, is just sort of like, she's just tolerating for the majority of the film. And then, of course, kidnap parents and a witch-type antagonistic figure who likes games in order to get those parents back at the end of the film. There's a lot in there, right?
Yeah, we've said as well in the past few episodes, this film's a little bit like Spirited Away. You go on this weird journey. You just have to not question it, just go with it. And this is kind of the one, right? Like, all the parallels you've just listed, I think... You know, when she asks the cat why he can talk and he's like, I just can. It's like, yeah, that whole kind of don't question it. Just come on this journey with me and let the whole thing unfold. We don't need to explain everything. I think just has such kind of Miyazaki energy to it. This one, probably the most out of all the Selicks that we've done so far.
Yeah. Also, it made me think of like May crawling through the tunnel to encounter Totoro. And that magic is just this thing that is kind of right on your doorstep and you just have to go through the tunnel and you'll get there, which of course we saw in James and the Giant Peach too. As you said, like that's what he wants in his stories, that it is just, you just have to go through this portal and there it all is, which is very, very Ghibli. That's very Cat Returns as well, that it is just if you kind of walk in the right direction, eventually this magical place will reveal itself to you.
Oh, and you also have something that we probably forget about because we talked about Ghibli so much over the years. Just the very concept of transformation and the possibilities of animation to distort and contort and change characters. And that's something that I suppose is aided by some of the technological advances from that had come about in the years since Nightmare Before Christmas and James the Giant Peach. But some of those transformations, when the other mother turns into her tall, dark, evil self, there's that. But then also the mouse that turns into a rat with this, when the sand is bleeding out, when it's bitten by the cat. There are so many of these moments where there are these technical visual effects flourishes that feel very Ghibli-ish to me, these characters that aren't what they seem or change at will.
Mm. Well, kind of to counteract the Ghibli-ness of it all, there's something that that kind of rubbed me the wrong way was the way that the film deals with food and weight as well. And I it's kind of a slight body-shaming film that I felt. Like, it's in the other world, you have the two performers who are revealed to actually have been wearing fat suits, and that the main villain becomes this kind of ultra skinny figure as well. And the fact that the only nice looking food that we see in the film, which does look really good, is in the other world as well. And maybe that's just because I get too obsessed about food stuff. But I don't know, it kind of felt like it was saying, like, whether you might be larger or very skinny, the idea of enjoying good looking food, and it is like bacon and eggs and stuff, not the healthiest, but just saying that that's bad, and that kind of did leave a bad taste in the mouth. And it's kind of seems like a bit of an easy gag as well, in both cases, an easy way to show someone as villainous or as kind of to ostracize someone. And I don't know, just I feel like that maybe wasn't considered at the time, but
maybe
perhaps wouldn't be done in the same way now.
I just took it as because whenever she opens the fridge in the real world, it's literally just like a moldy piece of bread or like an old banana peel or what, like it's just kind of mush. So her kind of whatever she wants materializes in the other world, and that's kind of, you know, a literal gravy train or huge pile of mash. Or
I like that it's proper gravy and not American gravy.
What's American gravy?
American gravy is like white and creamy, and it's like kind of looks more like the texture of a bechamel, and you have like biscuits and gravy, which is actually just scones with like a white creamy sauce.
Flavor is the gravy?
I've never had it, but if you Google biscuits and gravy, it's a funny looking thing.
Don't do it. It's not digestives and packs.
Yeah. So yeah, first time I heard someone say biscuits and gravy, that's what I imagined, and it felt horrible. But Michael, just going back to what you were saying about it almost being a musical, I think you have got like there's a lot of artifacts of it in there, not just the show pieces and the performance bits and doing the song and all of that, but like in the music of the film too, and we like that draws us back to another one of our studios and Cartoon Saloon, because we have to talk about Bruno Coulet.
I like his score a lot.
Yes.
In this. I think that it's Danny Elfman at various points, very sort of gothic and strange, but also very, very pretty. And then almost creepily pretty at other times.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly it. So it's like it's lush but also unsettling, and it's hymnal and euphoric, but it's also very mysterious as well. And absolutely, it's one of these things where I heard it and it kind of sounded familiar as well. It sounded like it already existed, some like the same way that he would use music in the Cartoon Saloon films that are steeped in folk tales, where it is original music for the films, but again it feels like it's steeped in kind of centuries of history as well. It makes it like adds to that kind of folk tale ghost story feeling of Coraline.
I think the songs that are, I guess, diegetic in the film, so the making up a song about Coraline and the kind of older ladies performance song, I feel like you can kind of see where something like Over the Garden Wall has got its musical influences. Those kind of, those songs that like you make up with your family or kids make up, and they don't fully register as a fully complete, you know, 3-minute song, but they're very catchy, and you know, they're just kind of spouted out as you're like at dinner or on a walk or whatever. I think that really, like, I think it does really well in that sense of having songs like that. It's fun that we've had so many musical elements in this kind of first half of the series.
Yeah, I think that would be top of my list if I ever got to interview Henry Selick again, because every time he has some sort of... He clearly loves pop music, even though it's not always there in the final cut. So if he wanted They Might Be Giants to score this film, or he wanted Andy Partridge from XTC to do the songs for James the Giant Peach, of course Danny Elfman was in a band before he was a composer, there's a lot of these connections. And then of course Brick House, etc. Let's Get It On, Foxy Lady from Monkey Bone.
Great scenes. Oh, Michael, in your research for the context, something I wanted to ask was about lights, because I thought this is like from when between James and Giant Peach and this, you got the evolution of LED lighting, which allows like really bright lights to be really, really, really small. And I think looking at the set, like this must be all done on LEDs, like the internal lighting, because that's the thing that I think is just staggeringly beautiful and which we haven't really seen in other stuff before. Whereas you might light a scene with studio lighting to make sure everyone's face is clear or not clear, depending on what you want to do. It's like the actual lights in the scenes in the film are amazing. Like the wardrobe that's a bug and has got a light within it. And the eyeballs that light up.
Yeah.
And when you have that wide shot of the garden and all the bulbs and the dragon snappers. And like it's all these... Well, the bulbs of the plants and the bulbs of the bulbs. But it just looks unreal. It's so, so good. And I just think you couldn't have done it when he was making his first two films, because, again, the technology just wasn't there.
Yeah, and we should shout out Pete Kozacik, who is the cinematographer, director of photography, who works across all these films, who is not only DOP for stop motion like this, he's also a visual effects artist. So he's completely up to date with all that technology and technique. And it's great to see that partnership flourish over, you know, 15 years between this film and Nightmare Before Christmas, and just the technology that's at their disposal.
And they show off as well. Like, they're a great one for staying through the credits for that.
Yes, they are. But you have, like, the high-tech stuff. And what I love is that it is a pure marriage of high-tech and low-tech, because, for example, they, for some of the garden greenery, they got popcorn and painted it, I think. I believe that's what it was. Or, you know, they have Steph's, probably your favourite part of the scene, Steph, the miniature knitting.
Yes.
Where literally, like, knitting the clothes for the characters with hair thread thin needles.
Yeah, but there's some really good behind the scenes of Althea Crome, who did the miniature knitting. There's good videos of her making Coraline's little blue star jumper, and it's just, I just don't understand how she did it. But I also, yeah, I really like the two older ladies knitting little outfits for their dogs as well, in the event that they die and have them stuffed. some good knitwear in this film.
Those dogs, I would love to meet a Scottish Terrier that has the temperament of those dogs. Having owned a Scottish Terrier and having met many other Scottish Terriers, they have far too much energy. A Scottish Terrier is just a lump that like flops around the floor. It might as well be a cushion that occasionally sprouts legs and wanders around. These are not my Scottish Terriers.
We could talk for 2 hours on this film, absolutely. One other thread I wanted to bring up, because you were mentioning Spink and Forcible, the two old ladies, time and again. And I agree with you, Jake, about like the sort of... fat shaming potential aspect, but I think that's just, it's Henry Selick in terms of the soup that he's emerging from pop culture wise. He's very Roald Dahl, isn't he? And Roald Dahl doesn't, you know, will paint larger characters as being negative or antagonistic in some way. Although I think it's more that they are clearly yearning for this bygone era where they were these stick thin dames of the theatre world. They're voiced, of course, by Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders, which completes the happy families of having Joanna Lumley in James the Giant Peach. Mm. So you have both of Jennifer Saunders on screen, kind of collaborators for Absolutely Fabulous, and then French and Saunders. But he clearly loves British comedy, British TV, and British actors, and closes that loop here. An interesting bit of trivia, I'm not sure how verified this is that... So Spink and Forcible, I can't remember which way around they are. There's the short, fat one and the tall, larger one. Of course, Dawn French is shorter than Jennifer Saunders, but they voice the opposite way around to what you'd expect. And that's because they originally did record those characters, but it didn't sound right, so they swapped characters.
That's interesting.
So you have Jennifer Saunders voicing the shorter one and Dawn French the larger one, which is a weird quirk of these films. But he clearly loves British actors within this big soup of inspiration that he's drawing from.
And loves enormous boobs as well.
That's another monkey bone aspect, right?
Yeah.
Going into this.
Yeah. Oh, actually, so on the monkey bone-ness of it, like getting a pet to jump into a rucksack, which is not something you see in much media whatsoever, but quite strange that two films out of four involve a character asking their pet to jump into a rucksack.
Well, I think it's time to tag ourselves, as we've been doing in all of the Henry Selick films. Michael, tag yourself. Who are you?
I mean, can I be YB? I've already made my case for how I'm YB. Jake?
I'm going to be Coraline's dad, but when he's presenting his dinner to the family. And that feels like when I've been given the reins of the kitchen and my partner is far more skilled than I am. And I feel like I'm always presenting some kind of slop. And I genuinely couldn't tell you what on earth that man has tried to make there, because it looks rancid.
Tried his best. Yeah. I've already mentioned it, but I'm probably the I Heart Mulch mug that Coraline's mum has. So many good little details in this film. Just... you want to pause and look at all of the all of the writing and backgrounds.
And this is one, I don't know if there is an Art of Coraline book, but this is one where all of the design work, all of the concept art, they had a guy called Tadahiro Uesugi who did the art, who would then go on, I think he worked on Luca, in fact, he worked on Big Hero 6. But John Klassen, who's like now quite a massive name in kids' picture books, worked on this early in his career. It's like all of the concept art is just amazing. It's worth looking up or tracking down that book if there is one available. What a film. We could talk for hours and hours and hours, can't we? Hopefully that's just scratching the surface of Coraline. But we've got a more important thing to do, which is to see where it comes in our top motion personal rankings. Let's get to it. Okay, guys, this is the hardest part. Or maybe actually, no, maybe not this week. Maybe not the hardest part. We'll find out. Top motion. We've got to rank these films. Is it better or worse than Monkey Bone? It comes back to that question, of course. Jake, I'll come to you first. Where does Coraline land?
Coraline is far and away the top for me. Most have been invested in the story, in the characters, and as a piece of craft, just astonishing. A remarkable piece of filmmaking. So, Coraline at the top, then James and the Giant Peach, then Nightmare Before Christmas, then in the other leaderboard.
In hell.
Yes, it's Monkey Bone.
Deep at the bottom of the old well, where it can't bother you anymore. Steph?
I'm struggling. I think Coraline just about inches into first place for me, but I still have so much love for The Nightmare Before Christmas. Coraline first, Nightmare second, Monkey Bone hanging in there at third. I still think it's good. And then James of the Giant Peach is last for me.
You know what? I'm going to put Coraline first as well. This rewatching it for this episode really confirmed it for me. I think this is one of the great animated films, maybe films full stop, that have come out in the time that I've been an adult writing about films. It really feels like a almost a miracle this film got made in the way it did, with all of the creative aspects behind it, that it came out the way it did. And as a nexus point between all these stories that we like to talk about on Ghibli Attack, this is the one. So Coraline, The Nightmare Before Christmas, they are the two jewels in the crown. James the Giant Peach and Monkey Bone lagging behind.
Oh, that's quite nice. Like last week, we were distant. Chaos where we all had different rankings, and now there's a little sense of unity to it.
So now the question is, should we put a pin in this for now and say for the selectionary, that is our rankings for the films of Henry Selick. And now, of course, the floodgates are going to open.
Oh, so Coraline gets the privilege of being in both as well. Do we do separate rankings? It's not really fair to rank the or is it? We could do we both. Let's do both.
We called it Top Motion to encompass the whole double mini series. Yeah. I think. But Coraline sits top of the heap, and with a consensus vote as well for the selectionary. We'll see whether Wendell and Wilde can trouble that top spot, I suppose, when that comes out later in the year. Wouldn't that be exciting? Mm. But for now, we are sticking with Laika.
That's right. Next week, we will be getting a bit of Paranorman Activity. And if you want to be getting some extra details and info and videos and articles about everything that we've been talking about in this episode and the whole series, become a patron, because Michael has been putting together these fabulous footnote documents that all of our patrons get, as well as access to our bonus Library Cafe episodes. And we're going to be adding into those episodes discussions about films that we've just talked about as well. So look out for episodes on The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou and Fantastic Mr. Fox, and another diversion into live action filmmaking too, as we further explore the career of Travis Knight beyond Laika as well. So all of that's happening on the Patreon. Look out for it. But if you want to just keep up with us and what we're up to, you can follow Ghibliotech on Twitter, where we're at Ghibliotech. We're on Instagram at ghibliotech.pod. You can email us, where we are ghibliotech@gmail.com. And actually, now that we've reached the end of the selectionary, start sending us your mailbag emails. We'll be doing a roundup at the end of the series, as we always do. So we want to hear your thoughts on these films, your memories, your controversial opinions, your rankings, anything you want to say, let us know. You can keep up with all of us individually too if you want to. So Steph's on Twitter at _StephWatts.
Michael's there at Michael J. Leader.
And you can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham.
Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ying.
Hello listeners, thank you for sticking with us through the credits. If you stuck through the credits of Coraline, you are presented with a very strange message that comes on screen, which says, for those in the know, jerkwad. So jerkwad was a secret password that you could use on the Coraline website. And if you entered that password, you got the chance to enter into a competition to win a pair of special Coraline Nike trainers. I wonder how they sorted out that crossover. This was only the first of many Laika and Nike crossovers. Every film from now on will have their special Nike trainers. I recommend looking them up because I think they look kind of horrible, but it looks certainly, there's certainly something to behold. Check them out.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.